I'm going to assume you know the lighting system, so whenever you're ready, Mr. Cooper.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Kirk Cooper on behalf of the appellant, Teresa Esparza. The McDonnell-Douglas framework for analyzing discrimination cases was never intended to be applied in a rigid, mechanized, or ritualistic manner. That's what this court said in DeBasi versus Motiva Enterprises just a few months ago when it reversed a district court ruling in which the district court took a piecemeal approach to evaluating the element of pretext. We contend that the district court here erred by taking the same piecemeal approach, and we ask this court to reverse the summary judgment rendered here for two reasons. First, as to the sex discrimination claim, the district court erred in its pretext analysis in several ways, most particularly by disregarding the statements of Ms. Esparza's supervisor, Matt Elliott, which the district court itself recognized were indicative of sexist animus. The district court first disregarded those comments on the basis that Mr. Elliott was her supervisor at the time of an interdepartment transfer. And under prior Fifth Circuit precedent, this interdepartment transfer was not actionable because it was not the equivalent of action. Later, we moved for Rule 59 relief because the law changed under Hamilton versus Dallas County. The United States Supreme Court has confirmed in Muldrow versus City of St. Louis that ultimate employment action test is no longer viable. The current test now is whether or not there was a change to the terms and conditions of employment. So our argument on Rule 59 was...
The district court got that right.
Yes, and the district court did find that the...
Help from me, because it's a tangled long story, her departure eventually. What was the adverse employment event, that the district court assessed A&M's conduct against? Was it the PIP? Was it the transfer? Was it the termination?
So
what did the district court assess the conduct against?
Yes, Your Honor. So in the original opinion, the district court found that the PIP and the termination were the operative employment actions. Later, when we filed for Rule 59 relief, we said the transfer is now actionable. The district court said, okay, I recognize that there has been a change in the law. Maybe this transfer is actionable, but I find that the statements of Mr. Elliott are still not relevant because he was not the ultimate decision maker. The CEO, Raminder Mann, was the ultimate decision maker.
And your argument to us is focused on which of those operative events? Or do you want to say all?
Our argument is focused on both, right? I mean, our position is that you have to take the totality of the circumstances into account based on her termination, which we think was sex discrimination and retaliation for filing an EEOC complaint. But also the transfer itself is now sort of an actionable. It is now under circuit precedent. So
okay, just two quick fact questions related to those. You don't dispute that prior to the termination, her sales were about at zero. There may have been, you may argue different causes, but just factually, her sales were very, very reduced prior to the termination.
Yes, I believe the record does show that during that particular quarter at the beginning of 2020, her sales were down.
Way down.
I believe that's correct.
Okay. And likewise for the transfer, it's an undisputed fact that she actually did have more audiovisual skills than anyone else. Is that fair to say? I'm not saying that's determinative of the case, but just trying to understand the context of both employment decisions.
Sure. So her sales mix, I believe, leaned more towards audiovisual sales and core sales. How much that lean is sort of a
But more than any other one employee there.
I don't recall if the record says that she was more than other. I know that her sales mix did lean more towards audiovisual.
Well, this wasn't a new product line that she was introduced to when she was transferred, was it?
Yes, that's correct. So she had some prior experience with audiovisual, but the record also shows that the company's audiovisual market only constituted about 10% of its revenue. So it was still sort of an untested market that they hadn't really developed.
Well, didn't they buy an audiovisual company, and that's the reason, one of the reasons anyway, that they reorganized?
Yeah, that's one of the reasons that they say they reorganized, yes, is that they had acquired an audiovisual company, and so they were looking to try and expand that.
Another factual question. Prior to the transfer, Ms. Esparza said she had about 10 to 12 million, I guess, potential sales in a pipeline. What was the evidence of that in the record?
That was just her testimony, is that she had said that she had about 10 or 12 million in the pipeline. I don't recall seeing anything specific from the other side where they dispute that or say it. I can't remember off the top of my head, but that is her testimony that she had a well-developed pipeline, and that during this transfer process, A&M started, you know, divvying up her accounts, taking away that particular pipeline that she had built up.
When you get to the pretext area, was there any evidence that the company treated men more leniently than they did her being given grace to the sales goal?
I'm not sure if there's evidence of that, but we do know that there is evidence that other members of the AV sales team, the Sabata and Bobich, who were in the Denver and Albuquerque offices.
In a different territory.
Well, there was testimony, I believe, from Patricia Barton, who was in the Albuquerque office, that while they were serving different territories, they kind of functioned together as one unit. In other words, if someone had a lead in one area or another, they would sort of help each other out.
Was there data about what their sales were?
I don't believe there was, Your Honor. I do know that there, Mrs. Spadasa's testimony was that Sabata and Babich were receiving more leads than she was, to quite a bit more leads. And so, you know, our position is that if you take a look at these AV sales team, they're all selling the same products, right? They're saying it's all selling audiovisual products. I believe they're all answering to Duffy. But Sabata and Babich are allowed to have a different mix where they're allowed to sell additional products, whereas Esparza was not.
How can you use those two men as comparators when you don't have any data showing how they were treated?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, can you repeat that?
How can you claim that those two men are comparators when you don't have any data to show that they were treated either more or less leniently than the plaintiff?
So I believe that there is data in the form of testimony that they were receiving particular extra leads that she was not, and that they were allowed to have a sales mix that consisted not just of AV products, but of AV products and other products. So while there may not be direct sales numbers to my knowledge, I do know that there is evidence in the record that shows they were getting leads when she wasn't. And so that would constitute disparate treatment in our view.
And on the leads, all you have is her testimony without any backup data.
I believe that's correct.
On the issue of whether or not the transfer is still in, I believe the other side argues that at some point she disavowed that the transfer was a part of the record. Do you have a response to that?
Yes, Your Honor. So as Judge Higginson was saying, there's kind of a weird procedural history here. So when the response to summary judgment originally came out, Hamilton had not come out, and so the law in this circuit was that unless it's the equivalent of an ultimate employment action that results in demotion or something along those lines, that it wasn't actionable. So,
at no time post-Hamilton had she ever disavowed that as a claim?
No, Your Honor. And in fact, even before this, she included it in her EEOC complaint. She included it as a factor in her summary judgment briefing. She's repeatedly advanced the transfer as a ground. It's just that before Hamilton, circuit precedent kind of bound our hands, but after Hamilton, we were allowed to raise that, and that's why we raised that in the Rule 59 motion.
You, of course, had to offer evidence that their poor performance sale was pretext. that evidence, you say, is an amalgam of things, starting with Elliott's comment about being over-emotional?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. That comment came months after the transfer, so that would only relate to termination, fair or wrong?
I believe that the comment was made during the—it was a performance evaluation, where the comment was made during the performance evaluation.
But she'd already moved over to the AV. So.
I think that was during the process of the transfer.
Okay.
I believe that's the sequence of events, is that that was during the process of the transfer. And in addition to the comment from Elliott, yeah, that the district court found.
And that comment really is, what are the exact words that he is said to have uttered?
The comment was that, and I don't have the exact words with me.
But it's pretty important, right? This is really at the core of your argument.
Yes, Your Honor.
What did he say exactly?
That she was, you know, essentially over-emotional in emails.
Did he say over-emotional or just emotional?
Just, I think it was just emotional. I think, you know, the conveyance was that.
So her boss for the AV section says you're too emotional in your emails, and it was specifically related to her emails with another individual, correct?
Yes.
Okay. And is it correct that Esparza did apologize for some of the tone in the emails?
My understanding is that she said that she would work on that, yes.
Yeah. So a boss saying the emails are a little emotional, I'm not sure. I guess your point is that there's an inference of sex discrimination in that, because emotion ties to women?
Well, the district court found that there was an inference of sex discrimination because it traffics in negative stereotypes about women. But that's not our only evidence of pretext.
What's your strongest evidence of pretext?
So the strongest evidence of pretext is all the factors taken together. So, for example, the same supervisor that made these comments was interfering with her client relationships. The company was basically taking away all of her leads, giving male counterparts leads when she was not getting leads. She had made complaints to Duffy. Duffy said that he didn't investigate. He admitted, you know, Marilis Stevens, who is the HR person, said there is a policy that if a complaint is made, it needs to be investigated. He admitted, you know, I just thought she was venting, which again, you know, another comment that tends to go towards the women are over emotional stereotype. And just the fact that there are other factors indicating that the reason for the termination, there's reason to cast doubt on that. So A&M is saying, well, it's her sales numbers, and her sales numbers show that, you know, her performance is bad because she's, a bad salesman, or she's, not making efforts, et cetera, et cetera. But there's also evidence in the record to show that her pipeline was basically taken away from her. She's being asked to start up in a new, unproven area for the company. She's not being given leads. Her existing clients are being divvied up. And so
those allegations are sort of setting her up to fail.
Yes, Your Honor.
Duffy ends up firing her, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
She was paid double commissions on her last 6 months of work, though, wasn't she?
I'm sorry?
She was paid double commissions on her sales for the last, 3 or 6 months of her work.
In terms of the offer of what they would offer her if she was able
to? I mean, to offset the idea that she wasn't given leads when she started, or didn't have a backlog, she was given double credit for her sales before the transfer.
Sure, and so I would like to point the court to testimony from Duffy. We cited this in our motion for summary judgment response. This is ROA 1614, and Duffy says in his deposition that the lack of the sales during quarter one of 2020 was due to the pipeline issue in the last quarter of 2019, and he does make comments suggesting that, well, we should have helped her map that out better. And he's asked, and would not having a pipeline in quarter four have impacted her ability to make her numbers in quarter one? And he says, yep. So in terms of
sex discrimination, that's seeming to assume a sales head is sort of building in internal fail for his own sales. So the fact that he would want them to not meet their own targets, that's the theory. So where does it trace back to a discriminatory intent?
Well, and there's
a comment about emotional.
It's the comment about emotional. It's the fact that Ms. Esparza had complained to Duffy prior to the transfer, prior to all this, about her disparate treatment by Matt Elliott, by others. She's being excluded from dinners. She's being excluded from certain opportunities.
By Elliott?
Yes.
Okay. Last question, because you will have rebuttal. But what, did you assert below to the district court the cat's paw theory, or is that coming up in your brief for the first time here to us?
So I see that my time has expired. Yeah, my answer. The cat's paw theory has been raised in response to an issue that the district court raised sua sponte in the Rule 59 opinion. That issue was essentially, we filed the Rule 59 saying Hamilton has changed the law, this transfer is actionable, Elliott's comments were found, so therefore we need to link them up. The district court discounted Elliott's comments by saying, well, yes, Hamilton has made this actionable, but I'm going to find that the actual decision maker on this was not Matt Elliott, it was CEO Raminder Mann. And so no one had addressed that.
So you raised it at that point, but only as to the transfer as an adverse employment. You didn't ever raise it in the context of her termination, yes or no?
We did not raise it because it was not made an issue until the district court issued
its Hamilton had nothing to do with termination, right? That's always been ultimate employment action. So Hamilton didn't change the playing field as to the termination.
Right. And so in terms of the termination argument, once that opened up the termination argument, the district court said, okay, I'm going to shift focus from who the actual decision maker was to the CEO, which neither side had argued. And so the issue is that the district court raised that sua sponte in terms of who the actual final decision maker was.
Trespass. You'll get your full rebuttal time. When you say no one had ever argued the CEO, I thought throughout you had stressed the CEO's comment, we're going to make an example of her. I thought that's been in this case from the beginning.
That's been for the retaliation. Yes, that's correct.
Okay. All right. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Rudd.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, Michael Rudd for Advanced Network Management, A&M for short. Teresa Esparza was a salesperson for A&M who was put in the best position to succeed during a company-wide reorganization of the sales force. But due to an unprecedented drop in her sales, she ultimately had to be let go. During this argument, I'd like to talk to you all about how the lateral transfer to AV sales and the ultimate termination are not the products of discrimination or retaliation. Turning first to the
talk up a little bit. It's to our systems.
Sorry about that. Speaking first about the transfer, I'd like to make three points. First, that the comment by Matt Elliott is not evidence of pretext because it occurred after the transfer decision was already made.
That's yes. Factual truth.
Absolutely, Your Honor. There's no, even Ms. Esparza's subjective statements, which have come up a couple of times this morning, and I would point out to the court that speculative and conclusory statements are not summary judgment evidence, she doesn't even make that argument. There's no disputed facts that the decision to break out all of the sales organizations so that they had subject matter experts in each product line occurred well before. And then post that, the decision to put Ms. Esparza into AV, because she was the person who was doing the most AV work, occurred. And that occurred in about October-November timeframe. There's some intervening causation issues in there. And then the transfer itself became effective on January 1st. And then Matt Elliott delivered Ms. Esparza's 2019 performance review in January after the transfer had already been occurred and was effective, well after the decision had been made.
But when exactly was the email with the, that's a little too emotional?
It was not an email, Your Honor. It was in her performance review.
It was in the performance review. Okay.
And my recollection of it, and pardon me if I misquote, he challenged her to be more thoughtful in her email communications because at times her emotions are clear. Paraphrasing, of course. And I would point out that my colleague has not asked, but it seems inherent that Ms. Esparza would like this court to create a per se rule that the word emotion is evidence of gender animus. And to that, I would say that no court has ever made such a decision. Understanding the historical nature of the word, I tread carefully, but I would like to point out that the district court relied on the Tenth Circuit decision in O'Shea, but the Tenth Circuit decision in O'Shea is easily distinguishable from this case because in that, the fact pattern of that situation was there was a comment about emotion, but the commenter also regularly made fun of his wife and other women, and pardon me, I want to quote this so that I don't get it wrong. He said that women in general were incompetent, stupid, and scatterbrained. And so I would just point that out, that the O'Shea decision out of the Tenth Circuit is magnitudes worse than what we have here. Here we have Matt Elliott's 2019 performance review, and then we also have Ms. Esparza talking about Ian Logan, and in response to why that criticism was made, Ms. Esparza says Ian Logan was, quote, very sensitive, and that's coming out of record citation 2465. And so to that, I would just say that at best in this case, the word emotion is gender neutral because it's going both ways.
Was there any evidence that Elliott had any influence in this termination decision?
No, Your Honor, and thank you for bringing me back on track. So first, the answer to your question is absolutely no. There's no evidence of pretext, and there's no evidence that Matt Elliott's comment impacted the decision of the transfer or the termination. Yes, Judge Higgins.
Well, no, following up on that, breaking the two events apart, it didn't have an influence on the transfer because it occurred months after the transfer, correct?
Correct.
But you're not pressing, but tell me if you are, that she's stopped from even arguing that the transfer is an adverse event. In other words, the district court found Hamilton extends to that. You aren't here telling us somehow she's stopped from acknowledging a change in law, or are you saying the district court was legally erroneous in how it applied Hamilton?
I think that that's a very close call, Your Honor. I think that the judicial estoppel argument that we've raised is viable.
But you're not pressing it as your first argument?
It's not our best argument.
Sure, I see its viability, but anyway.
Well, to follow up on my colleague's comments on it, Ms. Esparza raised the transfer as an adverse action, her EOC charge, her complaint, discovery, every step along the way until we got to summary judgment, and then she dropped it because it was a hard argument to make. And then post-Hamilton, it comes back in. The thing about it is, Hamilton didn't change the district court's analysis because the district court assumed the prima facie elements were met. And so whether her transfer was an adverse action or not, it wouldn't have made a difference for the district court's analysis. Going back to...
She paid more in the AV position than the one she had before?
She was. When she was transferred to AV, her base salary went up from $60,000 a year to $65,000 a year, and her projected commissions were more than she had ever made during her time with A&M. Of course, that didn't ultimately come to fruition. Speaking to the qualification element of her prima facie case and the timing of things, in November, when this transfer to AV sales and the breakout of the sales organization was becoming real, she told Sarah Cancellari that she was going to quit in January, and then she started turning down cabling leads.
She turned down what?
A cabling lead. So the Clint ISD deal, independent school district, or I think, was a lead that was being sent to Ms. Esparza by Cooper Heflick at the time, and it was as solid of a sale. If she would have just done the paperwork, she would have gotten paid on that, but she turned it down.
When you characterize she was going to quit, there's no evidence later that she did quit. There's no evidence that she refused to work. And the related question is, did she use those exact words, I'm going to quit, or I'm thinking about quitting? What do you remember?
So to answer your first question, no evidence that she actually quit, but for her sales going from $1.2 million enclosed to $19,000 enclosed.
But that does suggest she's still working.
It suggests that she is doing what's coming to her. In light of your second question, my recollection that the actual text to Sarah Cancellari was, I am going to quit in January. Please don't tell anyone. I want to hit on the cat's paw theory that you raised, Judge Higgins, and the waiver issue. This district court did not sua sponte raise a cat's paw theory. The district court merely stated the uncontroverted fact that Matt Elliott was not involved in the transfer decision. There's no dispute to that. And so far as waiver goes, this court has held that a litigant can't allude to an argument. They have to push it. And this cat's paw argument was not pushed at the district court, and the district court did not sua sponte raise it. I would say if the district court had sua sponte raised it, it would have cited this court's decision in Zamora and gone through the elements of Zamora, which are that Matt Elliott would have had to have made the comment for the purpose of having Reminder Man transfer Ms. Esparza to AV, and that his comment was the but-for cause of the transfer. There's no evidence of either of those things. And just to wrap a bow on this, there's no evidence of either of those things because that comment occurred after the fact. Turning next to the termination, which is largely based on retaliation, Ms. Esparza's theory, at least, is that it's based on retaliation. I just want to point out the legal standard going into summary judgment of pretext, and a very fresh case out of the Texas Court of Appeals, which really doesn't change anything, but it reinforces what has always been the standard, and that is that to avoid summary judgment, there must be evidence of suspicious timing and significant evidence of pretext. That's the Johnson and Capstone logistics case. This court has previously held in Wallace v. Sutton that there must be substantial evidence of pretext, and evidence is substantial if it is of such quality and weight and reasonable that a reasonable and fair-minded juror in the exercise of impartial judgment might reach different conclusions.
Let me ask you one thing. You know, I know it's the plaintiff's burden to establish pretext, but I kept looking for data showing what her replacement did after she left to just compare, whether she was just dogging it and not making her calls, or whether this was a bad territory or what.
To answer your question, Judge, directly, there is no evidence in the record of what her replacement in the El Paso territory did. What is in the record is that she went from $1.2 million in total sales, $700,000 of that was AV. She talks about her pipeline a lot with no supporting evidence. But if she had $10 million in her, she was predominantly AV, she was selling AV before she went to A&M at her prior job. AV was her expertise.
Let me ask you this. So they sell usually a small number of large sales, or do you have a large number of small sales?
Over the course of Ms. Esparza's career with A&M, it was a mixture of the two. There was a very large sale of AV equipment that was for the William Beaumont Hospital at the military installation in El Paso that helped Ms. Esparza make her 2018 quota. But other than that, it's a mixture of big sales and little sales.
And to what extent were leads responsible for those big sales? I mean, I can just visualize that a military base might call a company and say, I'm interested in this, and then the company would call the representative and say, you need to go see these people.
That William Beaumont Hospital was a subcontract deal. EP TechWorks was a subcontractor for the contractor doing work on the hospital, and A&M was the sub-subcontractor for EP TechWorks, who coincidentally is where Mrs. Esparza went to work after her employment with A&M ended. And just to speak, since we're there, about Remender Mann's comment.
Can you give me some idea of how leads worked?
The leads?
Yeah, I mean, to what extent did the leads, were the leads responsible for sales?
Generally speaking, by and large, the salesperson is responsible for generating their own leads. That's their job. There are rare instances that the Clint ISD deal that Mrs. Esparza turned down is an excellent example of this, where a client will come with a particular need and they're requesting a proposal. And so those things are more rare. Mrs. Esparza talks about leads, but she doesn't identify any leads. She doesn't identify why she should have been getting leads in Albuquerque and Denver. There's no record evidence of any of this. It's merely Mrs. Esparza's speculation and conclusory statements, which aren't summary judgment evidence.
I think you were about to get to my biggest concern about the retaliation claim. I think you were going there. EEOC charge filed in February.
Yes, Your Honor.
Sales down to zero by May.
Yes, Your Honor.
Fired in July.
Yes, Your Honor.
So that does look like a significant, legitimate, non-discriminatory reason. But then you've got what looks like the ultimate proof of a threat. The CEO's comment with a slideshow, we're going to make an example of this woman. Now, so is your entire argument that that doesn't even create an issue of fact because it occurred after she was terminated? Because you would agree that had that occurred right before termination, that would make this a classic case of retaliation, correct?
If it had occurred right before termination instead of a year after the fact,
CEO.
Yes, Your Honor. I think under that hypothetical, that probably would be a much harder argument for me to make. In this case, though, going back to the Rubenstein elements, the district court focused on the proximity in time, and this court's decision in Trotter to say that a year afterwards is not enough to find proximity in time. Addition to that,
no matter how offensive, no matter how directly on point. That's how you read Trotter.
Well, I think that I read Trotter the same way that the district court read Trotter, in terms of the truism that a year after is not proximate in time. I don't agree with the notion that Remender Mann's comments, which for the purpose of summary judgment we're not opposing, but I disagree with the notion that that is of such
impact
that it would slight the whole situation. And I say that because the undisputed evidence is that after Mrs. Esparza left A&M and she went to work for EP TechWorks, she was going to A&M's clients and using her lawsuit to compete against A&M. This slideshow doesn't say we're going to make an example of her. And to be completely fair, if you really read Patricia Barton's deposition testimony, she doesn't say that either. She says that it was her impression that that was what was being said. So Ms. Barton was reading into, Mr. Mann said this, her impression of what he said was make an example. So there's a step in between there that we're really missing. Gets back to that speculative and conclusory statements that aren't summary judgment evidence. But tying it all the way back to the ultimate issue, whether a rational juror could find that statement a year after, when Mrs. Esparza is using her lawsuit to compete, is made for retaliatory reasons. The only inference that the undisputed facts create here is that Mr. Mann made that comment, assuming that he made it at all, because he was upset that she was going out and using the lawsuit to compete. And it also, of minor importance, but that slideshow was at a leadership meeting. This wasn't sent to all of the rank and file employees to the company. And Mr. Mann's undisputed testimony on that issue is that he told them so that they would know that Ms. Esparza was out trying to get at the clients and, you know, just so you know, he didn't want his leaders to be caught off guard when they hear this from clients. And I missed a point on the transfer, but it ties into termination. This court's decision in Taylor versus Peerless was that if even assuming there was some gender animus or retaliatory animus, if the decision would have been made anyway, then summary judgment is still appropriate. In this case, we've got, speaking toward the transfer first, the whole company was broken up. Every salesperson lost some clients, gained some clients. They were siloed into product lines, into expertise. And so Ms. Esparza would have been transferred no matter what, whether it was to AV sales or whether it was to core sales. Transferring Ms. Esparza to AV sales, it just put her in the best position to succeed because she had $700,000 of AV sales versus $500,000 of core sales. And that was her expertise even going into A&M.
Well, that $700,000 consisted mostly of one big sale, though, didn't it?
That was in 2018, Your Honor.
Okay.
Don't believe that there's any record evidence of how that I stand corrected. There is record evidence of what that $700,000 was. It's a spreadsheet. Give me just a second here. ROA 780 to... No, I'm sorry. ROA 799, Your Honor, is the record citation for what the $700,000 was. That same thought process, though, applies to the termination, because if she was going to be terminated anyway, she had only made $19,000 in sales by July, it wouldn't make any sort of a difference. And there's also no evidence that Remender Mann had any influence on the decision. I see that I'm out of time. May I briefly
continue?
In conclusion, Your Honors, Ms. Esparza has not shown that discrimination or retaliation were the reasons that she was transferred or terminated. A&M asks that this court affirm the well-reasoned decision of the district court. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Cooper, rebuttal?
May it please the court. So I'd like to talk about the retaliation point, but before I do, I want to give the court some record sites. My friend on the other side had said, in response to questioning from the court, did Ms. Esparza say that she was definitively going to quit, or did she say she was thinking about quitting? Yeah. That information is at ROA 1802 to 1803. She's being questioned about this text message where she says she's going to quit in January. And then the question is, so you were planning to leave in January of 2019? Answer, based on the stress level and emotion and mental, and then question, okay. Answer, stress that I was going through, I was considering it. So she doesn't say, I'm definitely going to quit. She says, I'm under a lot of stress, so I'm considering it. So that
characterized the text, but there's evidence of what the actual text said?
There is a text that says, Sarah, I'm going to quit in January. And so she's asked about that, and she says, the context behind that quest is, I was under so much stress that I was considering it. So in terms of whether or not she was going to, that's a fact question. That's a issue of credibility and demeanor. Now, as for what Remender Mann said at the meeting and whether or not he said that he was going to make an example, I know there was a question. I'll point the court to Patricia Barton's deposition. This is ROA 2049. Question, at any point during Remender's presentation, did he say they were going to use a lawsuit to make an example out of Teresa? Answer, I believe they did. So there is testimony to the effect that Remender Mann made this statement, we're going to use this lawsuit to make an example out of Teresa Esparza. Now, in terms of the retaliation elements, Judge Higginson, you had asked about Trotter. We believe that the proper application of Trotter, first of all, I do want to caveat it by saying that it's not a published opinion, so it's not technically precedential, but it does apply this four-factor test. We don't believe that treating the time element as dispositive here keeps in, the spirit, basically, of the overall analysis of pretext. Pretext is supposed to be a totality of the circumstances test. The district court said that everything else about this statement, shows retaliatory intent. You have it from the CEO. You have him, making a direct threat. As Your Honor pointed out, if this comment had been made before the termination, that would be the end of it. Trotter is distinguishable because Trotter doesn't say this was just a matter of that this comment, which was, the use of a racial slur under somebody's breath at a restaurant after the termination, that comment was dispositive because it happened a year afterwards. It says, this comment came outside the context of the workplace. This comment came, in an ambiguous context where it was not clear that this was connected in any way to the employment action. And so we're going to treat this as not legally sufficient in our analysis. Here, the entire situation is totally different. We have the company's top official, CEO, at a meeting, flashes a slide on a PowerPoint presentation that says, Teresa Esparza lawsuit. We have testimony from Barton saying he wants to make an example out of her. And the district court said, I would find this dispositive, but for the fact that this time element has lapsed too far.
When was the meeting?
The meeting was about a year after the termination. It was August.
So a year and a half after the
I think it was like August 2021, if I'm remembering.
And she filed her EEOC charge in February of 20?
That's correct. So, but, by way of analogy, if we consider this as like a, for example, criminal case, if you're trying a murder case and you have a defendant that says, that guy had what was coming to him, makes all sorts of threats, 5 years after the fact, that evidence is admissible at trial. That evidence can be used to show evidence of retaliatory intent. And so it doesn't make sense in this employment context where this court has said in DeBasi, we're not supposed to have this mechanized, ritualistic application where we go element by element and try to shoot off individual elements.
Scanning the circuit in Westlaw, what's your best analogous case where top guy says something bad, but it's months, even years after? Do you have a case that is supportive as opposed to just distinguishing Trotter?
Sure. I was not able to find anything specific on that point. I think this is sort of a unique situation applying this sort of unique test. But we would encourage this court, because we do think it's an important issue of law, that in applying this four-factor test moving forward, that the time element not necessarily be dispositive. This is a totality of the circumstances test and not an individual test. And so for those reasons, we would respectfully request that this court reverse the summary judgment. Thank you.
Thank you both very much. We appreciate it. It will help us. And we will hear the last case for the day.